All right, so good evening. Good to see everyone here. The topic tonight is blaming, and the full title is Blaming. You did it, it's your fault, and I'm right. And a variation on that theme, which is almost as good, I kind of like this one better, is blaming. You failed to do it. It's your fault, and I'm right. So, either one, they have the same characteristics. So we're going to talk a little bit about this tonight. But before we start, you know, sometimes we break up into groups and talk a little bit. So we've got this nice big row here tonight, so we can say everybody on this side gets one question, everybody on that side gets another question. So. Don't break into groups until I say to, okay? So we're going to break into like maybe groups of three or four, okay? So everybody gets an opportunity to talk a little bit. We'll take 10, 12 minutes. So and I'm going to remind you of this after you get in the group, because I know you're going to be so excited to talk about it. You're going to get in the group, and then you're going to forget the question. So for the group on my left-hand side, your right-hand side, the question is, what is the primary or most significant element that distinguishes blaming from approaching a problem from a Buddhist or Dharmic perspective? Okay, so what is the most significant, the primary element that would distinguish blaming from approaching a problem or a situation from a Dharmic or a Buddhist perspective? Okay, that's on this side of the room. On this side of the room, the question is, once you start blaming, why is it so hard to stop? Well, you can kind of buy a position to do a trade. Okay, all right. So now. No, it may not be as easy as you think. See, that's the thing. So let's divide into groups of three or four on each side. Okay, so I'm going to start with, this is a way of backing into the question of what the most significant or primary element is of the difference between blaming and a Dharmic or a Buddhist approach to things. And this is about a train crash that took place in San Bernardino in 1989. And at the time that this first went down, I was actually doing a lot of business down there. So the night that the wreck happened, I was in Orange County, and it was spectacular. It was a big deal and lots of news coverage and lots of pundits coming up with quick answers of what happened. And it seems like really common, you know, so in the last maybe 25 years there's been a bunch of these big train accidents, and it always seems like the conductor is minutes before something happens is texting or something, right? And so they were just laying into the conductor, the lead conductor. And, on most of these big trains now, there isn't just a lead engine. There are multiple lead engines. So if you watch, you'll see frequently with the, not like Amtrak, but with the commuter trains, you'll see like 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 diesel engines out front and one or two in the back. And, if you've never looked at it, what you don't realize is all of them are running. There's not just one train in the front, one engine pulling everything. All 5 of them are running, okay? So there was a lot of blaming. You know, like with people, all they knew is that this big accident had happened. He had been on the phone, and so it obviously it was his fault, and they were really giving it to this poor guy. So this is the news story that came out based on a report, an investigation that was sometime later, So it says, on May 12, 1989, at 7:36 a.m., a six-locomotive 69-car Southern Pacific freight train lost control while descending Cajon Pass, derailed on an elevated curve, and plowed into a residential area on Duffy Street. Mm-hmm. I don't think this Duffy Street isn't named after Mr. Duffy, you know. The conductor, head and the brakeman, and two residents were killed in the crash. Seven houses on the street immediately next to the tracks were flattened by the train, as were the lead locomotives and all of the freight cars on the train. Clerks in Mojave had miscalculated the weight of the train, while the engineer and crew at the head end were unaware that one of the rear helper engines had non-functional dynamic brakes, and there was not enough dynamic braking power to slow the train down the hill, causing the locomotives to lose control of the cars. While the helper engineer realized that the brakes were not slowing the train, in desperation, he activated the emergency brake, which actually sped the train up. As the engineer did not realize that the emergency brakes automatically deactivate the dynamic brakes, the train reached speeds of about 110 miles per hour before derailing on an elevated 35 mile per hour curve next to Duffy Street, sending the head end locomotives and several cars off the high railroad bed and into houses on the street below, smashing them into pieces. After retrieving the black box from the locomotives, which I didn't realize they had black boxes, it was discovered that the third head and locomotive's dynamic brakes were not functioning at all, despite the fact that they were making the sound that dynamic brakes make. It was also discovered after the crash that the engineer running the helper engines knew of the faulty brakes on one of the locomotives and did not communicate the information to the head end locomotion. The combination of weight miscalculation, poor communication, and faulty brake equipment made the freight cargo heavier than the locomotives could slow, causing the freight cars to push the locomotives down the hill and rapidly gain speed. And this is a long sentence. And the curve next to Duffy Street was simply too sharp for the extremely high speed of the train, catapulting it off the rails and straight forward rather than following the curve of the tracks. Okay. So we start off with, you know, it's all the conductor's fault. He must have been on the phone. And we end up with this. And, you know, kind of the, you know, the initial question here is, well, there's so many causes and conditions. Is anybody responsible? And, of course, this is, you know, a favorite way that some people love to avoid taking responsibility. You know, it's like, well, gee, there's just so many causes and conditions that, you know, I don't have to take responsibility for anything, you know. But here, you know, this story, it's pretty clear that the clerks in Mojave really screwed up. You know, the tonnage that was being carried by the trains was miscalculated. So that was a significant element of it. The helper engineer activated the emergency brake, which actually disabled the dynamic brakes, which you would think by job description he would need to know, right?
Or a training issue.
Yeah, so it's either a training issue or a knowledge deficiency. Of course, the engineer running the helper engines actually knew that some of the brakes were faulty and for some reason never communicated that, which, you know, how do you make any sense of that? So there's a combination of factors coming together here. But because I was down there at the time and heard all the news coverage and saw the TV coverage and everything, and it was so dramatic that they were just pummeling the poor conductor, and the eventual investigation, not a word of criticism. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, that poor guy, you know, probably 80% of the people who heard about this never saw this, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he gets to live with, he's the guy who caused this wreck because he was on the telephone when it wasn't his fault at all.
I thought he died.
Excuse me?
I thought he died.
Well, his family had to live with it. Okay. So, I think, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, the answer to this idea that there, you know, there are so many causes and conditions. I mean, you know, we see this in a lot of circumstances. You know, we've gone through a whole series of things in our criminal justice system, where you know, people should be treated a certain way because of the way that they were raised, or because of their backgrounds, or because of their family histories, or, and you know, that principle plays out in many, many different scenarios. You know, you should treat me differently because of the conditions of my life. And from a Buddhist perspective, separate and apart from whether that's appropriate and whether all the social engineering that's going on in our culture is appropriate or inappropriate, that's not where I'm going. Separate and apart from all of that, from a Buddhist perspective, regardless of our pasts, and regardless of the conditions that we find ourselves in, we, each individually, are solely responsible for our states of mind, for dealing with them. And each of us individually is solely responsible for our conduct. And we don't get the luxury, from a Buddhist perspective, and this is one of the reasons that Buddhism is a minority interest in our culture, is we don't get the luxury of blaming the provocation that made us act a certain way, or the person who did something. We don't get to blame them for our state of mind, and we don't get to blame them for our conduct, or our anger, or our resentment, or our sadness, or any of that. We're solely responsible for it. And so there's many, many different ways, you know, as we all know, on all of these different issues that we explore here on Thursday nights, of evaluating topics. And so this is one way, on like this question of what is the primary or most significant element. And for me, and a number of you talked about it, is that, and I had said earlier about always try to go back to the basics. The most basic principle of Buddhist practice is that has to do with our intention. Our intention drives everything, right? And the deepest Buddhist intention is to investigate the circumstances that we find ourselves in, and what are the causes and conditions that led to the situation and my states of mind. If we don't do that, we actually don't know how to get out of it, and we don't know how to prevent doing it over again. And so it's, in the end, it's a question, you know, we were kind of getting really close to it, you know, and so it's actually the intention itself that saves us. I mean, if our deepest intention that we keep reinforcing is to investigate, and to actually investigate in a thoughtful way of what the causes and conditions are that I find myself in and that are in my mind, then that takes us someplace. And of course, blaming is just the reverse, right? You know, and the reason I like that little phrase, of, you know, you did something or you failed to do something, it's your fault and I'm right. It really characterizes the blaming mind. It assigns responsibility, it finds fault, and it has this rigidity to it. You know, there's no room for discussion when you're being blamed or when your mind is blaming. It's this rigid aspect. And there is no genuine effort to investigate the causes and conditions that are present. You know? And so, if you take the element out of intention, everything changes. It opens us to being reactive much quicker, to blaming, to being dysfunctional. That element by itself, you remove that, and then it makes us vulnerable to negative states of mind. In the end, all Buddhist practice, in the end, what liberates the mind is wisdom, and another word for wisdom is insight. And where does insight come from? It comes from investigating causes and conditions. That's where it comes from. Now, all of these many different practices that we do set up the conditions that allow us to have a stability of mind, to investigate from a place of relative neutrality. So the precepts help calm our minds, calm the agitation in our minds, and establish the foundation for inquiry. And then they act as a form of inquiry in and of themselves. You know, they start as a form of action. You know, like, well, I'm going to restrain myself from doing certain things. And then as you start to do that, and as your mind starts to calm down, you start to see the urges and the impulse, the causation that leads to your wanting to harm, or your wanting to gossip, or your wanting to engage in abusive conduct towards yourself around alcohol and food and cannabis and sex and all the many different ways we self-medicate ourselves. So it starts off as a form of action and then actually turns into a wisdom practice. You know? So all of the different practices do that. You know, like with metta, you know, we're trying to cultivate, and then as it really starts to take hold, it actually becomes a wisdom practice as well as an expression of the heart. So, you know, I think a series of thoughts about this. I think the blaming frequently is a defensive or habituated pattern or response to circumstances. You know, that we have a sense of who we think we are or who we aren't with certain people. We are in a certain kind of relationship that we're trying to maintain, and if we get into certain parameters where boundaries are crossed, we feel very vulnerable and don't have a skill set to stay there, to stay present and open to it, and so we do something dysfunctional, we blame. The nice thing about blaming, and this is the only nice thing I think about blaming, is that it immediately eliminates our having to be responsible for anything, because it involves assigning responsibility and finding fault. So it's not our fault. We didn't do it. We didn't fail to do it. It's somebody else's fault, and that's the whole idea behind blaming. So I get like temporary relief from the idea that maybe I'm responsible or played a role in this, but it doesn't last very long. And so in the end, and you just think about your own experience, blaming in the end frequently leads to a sense of guilt or a sense of shame. Yeah, because at some point, you wake up in your heart of hearts to the fact that, no, you were wrong, and you were abusive, and that you were unfair.
Or just the idea that somebody has to be wrong in a situation, and that seems even harder. Like, why does somebody have to be wrong?
Well, it's the nature of the dualistic mind. You know, once we get triggered and go into dependent origination, you know, we move through. We're talking about attachment, identification, and the minute you hit that, then you know, there's this very interesting article that I was reading in preparation for a residential retreat, and it's an article by the Dalai Lama. And so he's talking about the sense of self, and, you know, there's a conventional self, and not to get confused that this conventional self is in fact a separate, permanent, and real thing that you have to honor, that there is in fact a conventional self, but then when we start believing that what we think is the conventional self is in fact permanent, then it presents a problem. And the thing that he points out is that once you move through this process and become identified, which is the reification or the solidification of the idea that I am separate from you, then suddenly you are separate from me. We are no longer in a certain kind of relationship, which allows me to think of you and approach you in a completely different way. If I actually believe that you are part of me and I am part of you, that we are inexplicably linked, deeply linked, or Thich Nhat Hanh says interbeing, it creates a dynamic, a completely different dynamic of how I'm relating to you. Like for about 10 years, I did an awful lot of work in Hawaii, legal work. And it was fascinating for me, and it really worked for me. I loved working there because it is an island culture. And I may not work with you next week or next month or this year. I'm definitely work with you next year, the year after that. And so the kind of slash and burn tactics that you see in the legal community here, it's brutal, just brutal stuff, unfair, where the party with more money just beats the other person into submission, all this. You don't see very much of that in Hawaii. And mainland lawyers come over and do that, they don't get along very well. They don't last very long. And even you go into court, and the judges make it pretty clear by their attitude. I mean, they won't say it expressly, but just their attitude towards you, if you do anything like that, I mean, you either get the message or the locals get rid of you, you know. So, you know, this aloha thing is actually part of an island culture, and they talk about ohana, or extended family. And there really is a sense there that there is some greater connection of everyone there. And it mitigates this kind of more extreme conduct. So for me, it's always been kind of an illustration of where Buddhist practice is kind of taking us, you know. Here, frankly, I don't see it very often. I don't get that feeling, you know. Select groups of people and sanghas, you feel it, but in the larger community, I never get a sense of it. Over there, I get a sense of it a lot, you know.
But isn't that a new phenomenon? Because in the last 50 to 75 years, we've become more mobile. You can just move somewhere else, find new friends. You know, it's like when people lived in towns and knew each other, this, what we're talking about now, about how we are, didn't happen like this either.
Maybe. I don't know. I've only been alive for 65 years. And, you know, but I have this sense that things in... I strongly believe that the Western European idea of individual agency created and has been different than Asian cultures. They have their own problems, but this hyper sense of it's me, you know, is a different piece and manifests itself in different ways. And I think yes, it was better earlier, but the element that I'm talking about of like this Ohana idea, where it's not just my little Quaker community or my, I mean, like it's this island-wide thing, you know. I don't know, but in any event, for me, that's been an illustration of what may be possible and what a lot of what we talk about potentially looks like in real time, you know, if what we are trying to create could spread out to larger than like just our sanghas, you know, what it might start to feel and look like, right? So I think that a lot of times, and we talked a little bit about this, is that blaming is a result of projection. You know, that I feel inadequate or I'm fearful. I go into a meeting, somebody says something, and I actually think that they're saying that. They're not saying it at all, but I'm hearing something, and I project my fear out onto them. You know, if it's a teacher student, it's transference and counter transference, happens all the time. Suddenly there's this whole drama going on that doesn't have much at all to do with reality, but everybody believes that it is true, you know. And this gets quite sophisticated. You know, there's this wonderful book that has to do with memory, which is slightly different, but almost everything in it applies to this projection idea. And it's called The Seven Deadly Sins of Memory. And it's by the head of psychology at University of Harvard. And, you know, they go through all the things that are really common that we've all probably experienced. But, you know, one is misattribution. You know, like, you said something about me. You know, well, I never said that. It never happened, you know. But I believe that it did, you know. And, then lots of misrecollection things, you know, where because of our state of mind, because of our fears and what have you, we recast our memory to support a particular version of things. So, and as a lawyer, you see this just happen all the time. You know, witnesses come in and, you know what happened. And then it's just amazing what people think happened. And what they report actually did happen, and what they report people said, which no one ever said, you know. And I mean, I had this experience, which I've related before, where I was in a meeting several years ago, and there was myself and a physician representing a particular physician on a nonprofit board, and the physician said, if this board decides to do X, I will resign as medical director, which would have been devastating. Okay, so the next month, several of the board members say to me, well, you know, you better talk with XYZ, who's a board member, because they're really upset at you. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, you know, because of what you did at the last meeting. And I said, well, what was that? And they said, well, you know what it was. You know? And I said, well, okay, like, help me, okay? Just, you know, I did a lot at that meeting, so what is this person said? And they said, well, you know, when you said that you would resign if the board didn't do a certain thing, you know? So I found this shocking but familiar, you know, because I see it a lot, but I mean, this is like really dramatic. I mean, the doctor says, I'm going to resign as medical director, and the person can't handle the idea that the doctor would resign. So they remember that I was going to resign as legal counsel. Now, on the surface, it just sounds preposterous. And not only did this person believe it, but the two people on the board who told me I better talk with that person believed it because she was telling them that I did it. And they were saying, no, I don't think Dennis did that, you know. I think that the other guy... And then they were telling me that I did that. So now we've got three people on a seven-person board who believed that I threatened to resign. You know, it never happened, right? So when we have deep attachments to a position and they're significant, this is actually pretty common. And it's one of the reasons that this deep intention to genuinely and honestly with an open mind investigate is so important. Because frequently we think, we actually believe something happened, and if we reflect on it, investigate it carefully, we'll begin to see that there's some dissonance, like something is not working with that recollection or with that belief. And then you begin to realize that maybe there's something wrong with your perspective. I think one of the symptoms of blaming, you know, like if we're looking for symptoms, is anytime we get unconditional. You know, it's like, well, I tried everything I possibly could, you know, and they wouldn't listen to a single thing. You know, it's always been their problem. You know, particularly in relationships, you know, it's very seldom that there's one story, and that one person is responsible for everything. And even if something is developed in a way that, like, towards the end of something, somebody has gotten pretty rigid and unreasonable, there's a bunch of things that led to that happening. And actually reflecting on and seeing the role that we played in that is pretty significant in terms of just, you know, owning the reality of a situation and also seeing if maybe there's a way out. You know, maybe if there's some option. So, what might we do with this? And then we'll have a little bit of discussion. I think that, you know, watching for it happening, you know, this kind of the symptoms, and really, like, deeply cultivating an intention, reflecting on this intention and cultivating it, and then developing a series of experiential and cognitive inquiries that you work with is how we begin to get some traction on this, and traction on a lot of other things as well. The most obvious one is, you know, what are the conditions that have led to whatever this is, what the situation is. And the second one is, you know, what role have I played in arriving at this situation, you know, as an open reflection. And then I think the third one is watching, like, when you ask those questions, what happens? And the reactions that you have frequently are more telling than the answers that you're coming up with, because you can sense that you're defensive, that anger's coming up, that all the things that actually led to it that you're not clearly connected with, you can see in your reaction. And then, like we do with all of our exploration with this practice, we then turn to that. You know, when we explore how that feels in our body and where it leads us and what it reveals. So, like much of this practice, I think that the exploration, what we do, is conceptually quite simple and experientially quite difficult. And so the reason that I believe that intention and intention setting is so important is because it is so difficult experientially. Because you get in there and then you just get lost back in identification, and it becomes kinetic. You know, it's a thought, emotion, sensation in the body, and it just starts going, and then you're lost, you know. So. Okay. So those are kind of my, I guess, a variation on the theme of this, you did it, or you didn't do it, and it's your fault and I'm right, is, you heard me say this, Charles Barkley, the basketball player, you know, who was kind of like, he had this real act, you know, a mask of being like this really tough guy, and he talked trash and everything, and then, you know, he's been a commentator for years now, and then you see as a person, I mean, he's really a very humorous guy, you know, so you realize that that was a big act. But he wrote an autobiography, and it was entitled, I Could Be Wrong, But I Don't Think So. So that's probably close to the same neighborhood of what we're talking about. So, okay, so we've got a couple of minutes to talk a little bit. So thoughts, comments, questions?
So we need a little list of seven questions or something to ask ourselves when things come up.
I think actually there's three, you know, and it's like, okay, what are the causes and conditions, you know, explore that, what's my role, and then really looking at right now, what can I do to stay balanced, have some balance and equanimity of mind so that I can do the exploration, so you're watching, you know, am I getting lit up, am I getting out of balance, what have you. That's the other, you know, fundamental practice, right? Is we're always trying to come back to a certain level of balance, at least sufficient that we can maintain some level of neutrality towards the investigation or observation.
I was just one of the things that came up in our little group was the idea that the habits are our habits, and they feel comfortable, and that when you take the habits away, that investigation piece causes, at least, and what I just got now, is this sense of sort of amorphousness as an uncertainty. And uncertainty, when you're in the blaming back and forth kind of thing, at least for me, has been extremely disconcerting. And holding that in an open, fairly balanced way is quite a challenge, because it really kind of rocks. I mean, it really does rock a lot of identification and a lot of safety stuff. And I have a feeling I may not be alone in that. That I like certainty in interpersonal relationships and in knowing where we are. And the minute you take the cover off of that, a lot of stuff gets a lot less clear, at least initially.
Yeah, well, I think what happens is that it makes us feel vulnerable.
Yeah.
And then depending on, you know, our particular habit or the flavor of the situation, that vulnerability then expresses itself in all kinds of different ways, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a relatively low-level threatening situation, maybe we can stay there. And then as you escalate up, you know, our response can be all kinds of things, you know, I mean, denial, avoidance, you know, just freezing, what have you. But, I mean, you know, by nature, right, our mind wants to categorize things and create order so that the mind can orient itself. So, well, I know what to do. I know what this is. And this is one of the kind of extraordinary things about Buddhist practice, is it's designed to undermine all of that. It's actually designed to undermine the idea that everything is certain, that everything is stable. It's just the reverse. That's Nietzsche, that everything is in movement, and to begin to feel comfortable with uncertainty, ambiguity, and confusion. You know, so I think if you know, there's a handful of things that I can say profoundly influenced me at the beginning of this practice, and it was this one, was the idea that I could feel okay and not need to do anything in the face of uncertainty, ambiguity, or confusion. You know, so Alan Watts wrote this book called The Wisdom of Insecurity. And I found this book when I was a freshman in college, and I was that title had nothing to do with me. I was insecure and anxious and what have you. And I can remember walking into this bookstore, this little local bookstore, and seeing that title and just like being transfixed by the idea, you know, the wisdom of insecurity, that like insecurity was like a good thing, right? You know, for me it was the most threatening thing in my life, you know. So that was profound, you know, because I played around a little bit, but that put the hook in my mouth, like that, man, this is extraordinary, you know. So, yeah. But let's give somebody else a chance, okay? Yeah.
Sure.
Yes.
Some of the news this morning that came from the European newspapers is an image of a Syrian refugee child on the beach dead, and all the outrage that is going on because nobody's doing anything. And I thought of the Dalai Lama, how he doesn't blame the Chinese government for what happened. I'm still struggling because, and this is not a question, of course, about politics or anything like that, but how to avoid not blaming the people, politics, who has allowed this to happen for 4 years, that keep continuing the allowance of this happening.
Yeah.
So how to avoid it?
Yeah, it's big stuff, and I think with the Dalai Lama, and there's a number of other illustrations, but you have people who have such a deep practice and such a spacious mind. You know, this is the other thing about practice, is the more that you practice, the constriction that's caused by attachment and identification keeps loosening up. So if you kind of think of like a circle, you know, the circle of inclusion just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And with the Dalai Lama, I'm sure that, you know, awakening is there's no boundary left, you know. And I don't know if that's where he is. He says he isn't, but who knows. But there's, I think we can be appropriately aggressive in holding people accountable for their conduct without blaming. Okay, the blaming piece creates a rigidity. It clouds our vision. It's not clear seeing, you know, but clearly seeing that somebody did do something that shouldn't have been done, or they failed to do something that clearly should have been done, and assessing their intention, you know, doing a proper investigation, and then holding them accountable is part of, I believe, a true Buddhist approach to living in the real world. You know, it's not about, you know, it's, I said, you know, we are wholly responsible for our states of mind and our actions. That's true. I mean, it's absolutely true. Also, like, if somebody in here is impinging on me inappropriately, it's my obligation to protect myself and not put myself in harm's way. You know, it's not like, oh, well, gee, you know, love conquers all. You know, the only way that, you know, love transmutes hatred. Well, that's all true. And so I have to hold it in a certain way. But that is different from whether or not I create appropriate boundaries and I hold people accountable for what they do to myself or other people. You know, this is where I think Joanna Macy, who's, you know, Joanna is, you know, she's aged now, but her work is just a fantastic illustration of this, because she started in the late 80s and 90s, and it was all about the environment and the destruction of all our natural species and the threat of atomic weapons and the dangers of nuclear plants. And so this was one aggressive lady, you know, but she was not blaming, you know. So I've always thought that she's a real inspiration and an illustration of what we're talking about here. So. Okay, so 2015, I want to thank all of you for coming and being open to considering all of this, and in a world where there's so much suffering, they are genuine efforts. And I believe that that's what we're doing to educate ourselves and to change ourselves and to change the world really has some true impact and ripples out to the rest of the world.